Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon. I want to welcome you to today's show of the American College Experience. My name is Jason Haynes. I'm the host of this show and also the Chief Executive Officer of the UR Tennis Network. We've been operating for about 5 years and so excited if you joined us today for your first time. On today's show, we have Steve Clark. Steve is the head men's coach out at Eastern Washington University, and get to him in just a little bit. As many of you know, we have been in championship season, NCAA, NAIA, and NJCAA championship season. And I'm going to get to the list of winners here in just a second. Let me remind you that we don't just do one show here on the UR Tennis Network. We do 4 shows right now, and we're currently working on several others. And our list includes on Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock Central Standard Time is Lisa Goodman-Stone. Lisa does Parenting Aces out of Atlanta, Georgia. On Wednesday, we have American Tennis with Chuck Creasy. Chuck broadcasts out of the Citadel in South Carolina. And on then we have my show, which comes on Wednesday afternoon at 1. And Chuck's show comes on 11. And then we have the Florida High School Coaches Association perspective, and that is John Denise, and John does his show Thursday afternoon 5. These are all the live times that you can catch these shows. If you miss it live, don't forget that you can podcast this episode and any other episode that the UR Tennis Network does on our iTunes page. You can download any podcast that we have there. We've been doing it for 5 years, so if you start today, you might have a few hours worth of listening entertainment. And excited that you have tuned in for today. Like I mentioned before, we have head coach Steve Clark. He'll be coming on here shortly from Eastern Washington University. But first, let me get to the championship news. And I just quickly want to go through the list of championship teams at each division. It has been a weird May here in Texas. We've had tons of rain, if you haven't heard about us. But they managed to get all of these championships done on time. And we will follow up with each of these coaches and get them on our show in the summer. They will come on, tell us their story about their national championship season, and let us know the ups and downs of the season. But the NCAA Division I level on the men's side, Virginia won, and head coach Brian Bolin has been on the show before. Vanderbilt University won the women's. At Division II, Barry defeated Hawaii Pacific. And then Armstrong State, and that's in the men's, Armstrong State won the women's. At Division III, the men were won, and I said this before, by Claremont Mud Scripps, which doesn't seem to be fair. You've got 3 teams there versus everyone else. And then on the women's side, Williams won. At the NAIA level, Georgia Gwinnett, the men, and Coach Chase Hodges, who's been on the show before, his team won the men, and then Auburn Montgomery with head coach Ruben Vargas, who's also been on the show before, won the women's title there, and we'll look forward to having each of these coaches come back on and explain their championship season. On today's show, as I mentioned, head coach Steve Clark. Steve has over 25 years experience, college experience, and let me put successful in there, so it's 25 years of successful college experience. He's the fourth head coach at Eastern Washington University in their history. He's had the stints at Chapman University, Texas Tech University, and UC Irvine. And let me see if I can bring him in here. Hi, Steve. Are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I can hear you loud and clear. So excited you've joined us on the show today, Steve. But with many of my coaches that come on the air, there are going to be a lot of people out here that just don't know who Steve Clark is, and that's why we wanted to interview you today and let America know who you are and where you're at. So if you could, first and foremost, do a little biographical information here, biological information on who Steve Clark is and how he ended up at Eastern Washington University.
Well, first off, thanks for having me, Jason. And it's amazing what technology does these days. So,
sure is.
I grew up in a small town. I won't start too far back, but I will say it's funny. I was talking to John Whitlinger, who grew up in a small town up in Wisconsin, and we were just talking about father-son coaches, coaching their kids, and he grew up in a small town, and obviously he went on to win multiple national championships, et cetera, but. I came from a small town, Gilroy in California, and played down there. And so in short, I went to college up at UC Davis. And one of the things I tell my players and juniors is at a time, when I was a kid, I was known for, we kind of had one style of game back then. It was pretty much serve and volley, et cetera. And I went to college when I started playing, I had a bit of a temper, and then by my junior year, I decided, if I can't do this game on her, I'm just not going to play. So I ended up just getting ready to play football and started lifting a lot of weights. And I figured if I could get mad, I could hit somebody, on the football field. But then I used that summer to kind of really gain control of what I was doing on the court, and came back, and that's when I was an All-American and number two in the country. And, to those coaches and players who've won national championships, kudos, because it's something people can't take away from you your entire life, even coming in second is a great thing, but first place is a lot nicer.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So anyway, from that, I went on to coach. I was one of the younger coaches in the country at the time. I went on to Chapman University. We ended up going fourth in the nation, and I was just right out of college. And then I ended up going over to UC Irvine for a while, and I was the head assistant there. And then I went to Texas Tech for a year. The NCAA had some rules that wouldn't allow me to make the kind of living I needed to as an assistant, so that was a short-lived rule change. But so I went to Texas Tech, and that was a great experience, great people and whatnot. And we had, for the first time in 30 years, we beat Texas there. Those guys were kind of a ragtag group of guys. I worked their butts off, and we even had TV cameras at practices at 6 a.m. in the morning. It was a pretty neat deal, and those guys, they really rose to the occasion, and for the first time in 30 years, we beat Texas, and they were top 15 in the country, I think, and so that was a pretty big deal for those guys, so that was pretty neat. And then I was in Jamaica, actually, one summer. I do some stints in Jamaica. I did some, I teach tennis, but I windsurf and scuba dive most of the time. And I get a call, and they were opening up UC Irvine because Greg, my good friend Greg Patton, he's at Boise State, he headed up there. And so they wanted me to, look at the position. I said, yeah, sure. So I went back, and I was there for 14 more years. And we had, top 16 teams, top five guys in the country, and, former players of mine went on to the tour. And, the current coach, Trevor Cronin, was the size three in the world. So just a great experience there. And then, more importantly, I met my wife, and we sired three wonderful kids, and we started late in life, like kids that were like Sarah and Abraham, we started pretty late. And in fact, I have a little story there, if you don't mind. I call it 0 to 4 in 30 seconds. I was sitting at the table one morning, and. My wife had gotten a bonus from work. She worked for a computer company at the time. And she said, so what would you like to do with the money? And I said, well, whatever you want to do. We could put it away. You could save it. You could go on a trip or something like that. She said, well, how about our kids' college education? Well, at the time, she hadn't wanted kids, and, you know, my team were my kids. You know, my team, yeah, I had 18 guys on the team at the time, I think, and, you know, they were my kids. They come over to the house, and, you know, that was the family. And so I literally almost fell out of my chair. So I was like, what are you talking about? We don't have kids. And she says, well, I'd like to have some. I was like, oh, my gosh. I go, how many would you like to have? And she goes, 4. So, you know, from that moment from 0 to 4, you know, so after that we tried. But for 10 years we tried, and we had several miscarriages and whatnot. And actually, that's another story in itself. Vic Braden, a good friend of mine, I was running a big event. We were raising money in honor of a former coach, a guy named Myron McNamara, who tons of your listeners who've been around for a while probably know who he is. He was Jack Kramer, also a good friend. He started the ATP Tour kind of as we know it. They would travel around Southern Cal, and they would put on these promotional events. Anyways, he was my assistant. So here's this 30-something-year-old guy and then this 70-year-old coach, you know, who's my assistant coach, and it was hilarious, but he was a great coach, and so we had fun there. But I was at this event, and I was running this event, this golf event at Jack Kramer's club. He would donate the club, the generous man he was. So we were playing golf, and then we came in and had a dinner. Well, at that dinner, I was getting up to MC some things, and my wife got up, and I'm thinking, what in the world is she doing? You know, it's normal she doesn't, you know, get up. And so she got up and she said, Vic Braden is videotaping this. And, you know, the late, great, 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 great. He's just an awesome man, Vic Braden. And she got up and she said, well, my husband, he's a great coach. And he said, but he can be a great father. And the place erupted. And, you know, that's when the first time we were pregnant after years and years of trying. So. All that to say, then we had, you know, 3 wonderful kids, and we moved up here, you know, we just, you know, enjoy the PNW up here. We live out in the country, have a court at the house, and it's just a great place to raise a family. And Eastern Washington is a really family-oriented, nice place, and they're good people. So it's that's kind of a short story.
Very good, Steve. Now, tell me a little bit about Eastern Washington. How big is this school?
That's about 12,000, and it's called, you know, a mid-major, similar to what UC Irvine was. You know, one of the things that's given them a lot of success in the recent years, their football team won the national championship in 2010 for the subdivision. But they can hang with they can hang with the big dogs. They almost beat UW. They beat Oregon State. You know, so they can play football with the big boys. And so that's been, they've been really put a lot of emphasis on that. And then the basketball team has done quite well. And, you know, the other sports, they, you know, it's like a family. They fight hard. Student-athletes know each other. There's no prima donnas. And so the entire department is geared that way.
Those 12,000 students, why do they come to Eastern Washington, Steve? What are the big draws?
Well, Eastern Washington is in Cheney, which is a small college town, which, you know, as, you know, people know a lot of times college towns, it's, you know, the environment can be really nice and wholesome. If you're sending a daughter or son somewhere, it's a very safe environment, very nice, wholesome environment. There's just stuff to do. There's, you know, if you want to do rivers, lakes, you know, anything in your spare time, ride bikes, go outside. I mean, Eastern Washington is not like Western Washington. Western Washington, it's pretty rainy, gloomy at times. Eastern Washington is pretty much just an arid desert with snow, so occasionally. You know, in fact, it's funny, when we first moved up here, people thought, you know, you're from Southern Cal, you know, you're this guy, you know, down here, you know, coach these guys, et cetera, and, you know, play ten. I still played a lot of open tournaments and some futures when they go through the area. I mean, so I was a player and even as a coach. So we moved up here, and the first winter we were here, there was the biggest snowfall that ever, you know, the history of keeping record, I think. But to us, it was a blast because we somewhat lived in the country and we could go out and do stuff, and you have moose and deer in your backyard, and, you know, that's pretty fun. So there's a big draw for things like that, and, you know, just a nice country. And then secondly is they do, you know, the academics, you know, they hold their own against, you know, a lot of schools. And one of the things, it's actually one of the cheaper public institutions in probably the West Coast. And because of just the area, it's not, it doesn't, the cost of living isn't real high here, et cetera. And then they have activities, and it's very, like I say, student oriented. So you don't feel like a number. For example, I was just on a flight back the other day, and I won't mention the other school because that's I don't like negative recruiting. So, but the other school this kid had gone to, his dad was telling me about this, and he wasn't an athlete. He's just a student and a student athlete. He was a regular student, and his dad said, well, he just felt like a number at this school, and this school is in Washington. It was the big school, and so he just felt like he was just kind of on the treadmill, and so he's really enjoyed the smaller, personal attention. To give you an example, one of the things I started, we have a fall tournament, and I want to be able to promote things and get fans. We had the largest fans the program's had this year, and you got to get people out there and make it fun. So one of the things I did is I had an exhibition, and years ago when I had Roy Emerson up here, he was running some clinics with me at a club, and he emceed this exhibition match. So I played with a former player of mine who was top five in the country, and then we played against two guys that had been on tour and who played at UW, and they're just great guys, and just, they know how to do an exhibition, have fun with it, network, mingle with the crowd. So we're out there playing, and now I lost my train of thought. Where was I? What was the point I was making?
We're talking about some of your players there at Eastern Washington.
So
recruiting.
Right. So then So then we had an exhibition, and it was just great having people out there. It was mainly to bring, notoriety to the club and some things we were doing, et cetera. Well, so I got one of the local sports writers. Columnist rather, Doug Clark, and he's just, if you read his articles, and so very well known in town. So I got him out there. He likes tennis, so we went out there and got also a president of the club at the time, and Gary Gaynor. So we were out there, and I offered to give them some martial arts gear, head, mouthpiece, chest plate, cup, and all that to be able to play because I was playing with another college player. And to do this exhibition match, but he declined. And so we had a really good time, but one of them did get pegged, and that was, it was kind of humorous at the time. So yeah. This time around, we had an exhibition. What I did is I asked one of the professors on campus, had one of my student athletes, had so Doug Clark, the columnist. So we basically I want to integrate the community through, media, faculty representation, athletic representation through me, and then one of my players. So I wanted to kind of bring, the university together in that sense. And so we had an exhibition beforehand, and that was a blast. And again, this time I have a picture of it. It's pretty funny. I gave him one of our staff is really into baseball, and so they gave him I gave him a catcher's mask and a catcher's chest guard and all that, so to make sure he didn't get hurt this time. So. So anyways, the idea is that the things like that are, trying to build up more fan base. And so the university is real small in that sense, where you can reach across and, get to know people quite easily.
You just completed your first year there at Eastern Washington, only the fourth coach in the history of the program. What kind of courts, what kind of a facility do you have up there, Steve?
There's 8 outdoor courts, and there we just kind of did some upgrades where we did make it more of what we call branding, in terms of putting up real nice logos, windscreens on the sides, and, some banners going up top. And we have some indoor courts. It's a multi-use facility. And so we actually redid the complete surrounding of that with logoed backdrops and windscreens. So that's a much nicer facility. But we are looking to, eventually we'd like to be able to build a tennis only or shared. A lot of teams do this now. For example, they might have a tennis facility, share it with golf, or share it with sand volleyball is becoming big. And so sometimes you can share a facility project. When you're going out getting those done. So, it's funny. It's just either the Southern Cal blood in me or I just refuse to be indoors. If it's sunny out and a ball bounces, we're outside. People would say, hey, man, put the nets back up outside. Like, I leave the net at my home court up all the time. I never take it down because I don't care if there's snow on the ground. If the court's dry, I'm playing. And, in fact, I had one girl who trained. I was getting her ready for college, and this was years ago, and she practiced in 15-degree weather, and she was tough. So I tell some of my guys, if they ever get a little soft, I say, hey, there was a girl that practiced in 15-degree weather, had icicles on her eyebrows. So
I would imagine that the weather is it a friend or an enemy up there?
The what? The weather?
The weather, you know, when you have to account for as much rain as we understand goes on in Washington, I realize you're in the desert, but does the cold and the weather, does that affect some of your practices and such?
Oh, sure. I mean, sure it does. I mean, I remember even when I was in Southern Cal, I mean, there was sometimes you couldn't breathe because of the smog, so you had to kind of do that, or if you had some of the gusts from the Santa Anas. I mean, you know, most places have something you have to do with. But here, like I said, we practiced outside quite a bit, and that's just A, my stubbornness, or B, tennis is meant to be an outdoor sport. Yeah,
yes,
so you gotta go as much as you can with it outside. You know, the wind is your friend. You gotta learn how to play in it. And so if it's breezy out, we do that. Same thing in Southern Cal. Same thing in most places. Like I say, it really does not rain nearly as much as it does on the West Coast. On the West Coast, so it's much more arid here. The main thing is going to be if you have snow on the ground. Yeah, then we practice inside. So it's But this year was very mild. I mean, for example, I had the nets up, I think, all year. You know, I had them put them back up, and we were out on the courts, you know, pretty early. And but you have the luxury of if you need to go in, you go in.
Yeah.
Like some
being
teams
a
only have indoor.
So. Go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Say it again.
I was going to say some teams only have indoor facilities, and I think that would drive me nuts.
Yeah. So the first-year coach, he came in from a unique situation. You had to take over a team. What were some of the things you first had to implement there, Steve?
Well, that's a good question. And that's actually, you know, a lot of things I talk to you about when I talk to, youth groups or, you know, kids or tennis players or other coaches is, we talk about a tennis culture. And, having come from a program where we were, even top 16 in the country, and I even, I've told the guys even stories where I've had guys, we had eight guys in the team, three of them were injured, and we still beat a top 20 team because there's a belief system. There's a culture. And so that's important. So one of the first things, and having, not really gone, I've never really been involved in the team where I didn't recruit all the players. So like at Irvine, even when I came back to be there full time, I'd recruited a bunch of those guys or been involved in the recruiting. So I still knew most of them. So these guys were all new, but from the very first day of practice, it was, we had a lot of two-a-days and it was hard. These guys, I know they hadn't worked that hard. And they, you could tell in guys' eyes that they loved it. You know, it's like, hey, this is going to get me somewhere. And, it comes down to one of the things I have a mantra that we use. And, in fact, there's a lot of – you got to change things visibly and internally. So, for example, a lot of things I did is right away I had a practice shirt from the day one on. They had a practice shirt, and on the shirt it says, has PRPR, focus, always. And each of them has a meaning. So one of the things is, first of all, always. If you always give your best, you'll sometimes play your best and one time be the best. The problem is most people don't even know what their best is. So I have a little jump test I do with athletes at all ages, all levels. And so I have the guys do that. And then the light goes on, like to a degree where they understand, okay, my best is, it's kind of a tricky thing. Even when I spoke to a sports management class at a local university, I had a couple people do it, and they get it. It's the idea that if we always give our best, that alone is tough for people to do. Sometimes I'll challenge guys to say, look, give me give me a half hour of complete focus where they're absolutely, can you even actually be on your court 5 minutes without looking over to see what happened somewhere else? And
right.
So just even small things like this that you can help create a culture of discipline and focus. And, obviously you have your fun, but what player has fun when they're losing? It's you have fun when you're winning, when you know you've given your best. That's where the adrenaline, gets into it in tennis. So the first thing is, if you always give your best, and that means that's fundamentally. So that has to do with mental, physical, technical, tactical. Are you giving your best? You know, was that shot your best shot, or was that just a you know, a brain synapse misfiring? You know, I mean, did you really give your best on that? And being able to get that out of them. Then the second part of that is, you will sometimes play your best. Some players have it backwards. They think, I'm not playing my best. You don't have to. How many times have you won a match playing horrible or not even your best, and you win? You know, great players, that's what they do. It's kind of like a pianist. You don't know great pianists screw up 50 times. You know, they cover it, and they still come out with a masterpiece. Well, it's the same thing with tennis. You know, Federer, you wouldn't believe how many times he mishits the ball or doesn't like this shot or that shot, and he comes off the match and he wins. Well, he gave his best. He didn't play his best. So the goal is, if you always give your best, you will sometimes play your best and one time be the best. You cannot be the best unless you've given your best. I mean, some people can win a tournament or, you know, win an event or some single thing without maybe giving their best. But then again, that's nothing. It means nothing because it was too easy. So the idea is, are we always giving our best? So that kind of culture you have to call guys on it when it doesn't happen. Okay, that's an example of not giving your best, and this is an example of giving your best. And, you know, you just upfront and honest. You say, was that your best? No. Okay, let's get back to giving your best, because only then can you expect to sometimes play your best. And the goal then is, hey, if we want to have a shot at conference to be the best, well, you got to do these other things. Now, winning conference isn't always the single descriptor of being the best. For example, if you always give your best and you'll sometimes play your best and one time be the best, well, maybe that one time is just in practice. Maybe it's in that tiebreaker. Maybe it's that point. It just depends how you break it down, but that's all that matters. It's one point at a time. So it's not necessarily, hey, I've got this out here that I'm going after. It's, hey, day-to-day best, that sort of thing. So another thing on the shirt was what I call focus. I developed this years ago with some of my captains. We were at the All-American Tournament in Texas in Austin. And I asked my captains, we're sitting there on the couch, I said, guys, we got to come up with something here that really encapsulates what you know that I believe and that what you guys have bought into. And what is that? And so the idea is focus. So it's fundamentals, opportunity, conditioning, unity, and success. So if you have the fundamentals down as a team, and that incorporates technical, mental, physical momentum management, all those things. And you're given the opportunity. And that opportunity means every day is an opportunity. I talk about, what are you doing with the dash? There's an old saying, an old poem out there. What are you doing with the dash? Well, we were born and then we die. What are you doing with the time in your life in between? But that dash can also be shrunk down to everything. Like, for example, what are you doing the first time you step on court at practice and when you leave? What are you doing between the first and second serve? What are you doing in your classes and your social life and your eating habits, all those things? What are you doing with dash, okay? So those opportunities, the second letter in focus, is those opportunities are given to you every day. So, and I, as a coach, I need to provide them. So I need to provide opportunities for pressure. I need to provide opportunities for excellent matches. Need to provide opportunities for, you know, fun, for, you know, conditioning, all these things. So when they're there, that's the F-O, and then C is conditioning. You got to be in better shape than your opponent, because deep down inside, if you know you are, when the push comes to shove, you know that's not a factor. That makes you more mentally tough. And then unity, if we have team unity, that's huge. And that's another thing I talk about in terms of goals, product-oriented goals or process-oriented goals. In other words, if we're more process-oriented and one of those processes is what's called team cohesion, there's a study that's been shown that team cohesion is a much bigger predictor in success than what you might call goal, like, hey, we're going to win conference, everybody's on that same goal. If the team unity and cohesion is high, that has a bigger predictor of success. Anyways, then you will have success. So if you have fundamentals, opportunity, conditioning, and unity, you will have success. I mean, it's kind of almost intuitive. And then the last thing, so on the shirt, is PRPR, is positive physical response, relaxation, preparation, and ritual. And Jim Lehrer, who's a sports psychologist, I don't know, probably 20 years ago, he brought me out on a court, and we were doing some things at a convention. And it's natural for some athletes, and this is what I point to people to, is look at a great athlete on the tennis court. What do they do between points? How do they react to win-loss situations? The naturals, they naturally gravitate towards positive physical response, relaxation, preparation, and ritual. I won't go into it, but that's – so just a thing like that, just a practice shirt could get us focused every single day, and it always provided a way for me to say, look, we look like a team. We can always point to the things on the shirt and talk about them. So that would be, you know, just even a small thing I did, just trying to get guys all on the same page.
Well, Steve, I mean, you came into a situation where a philosophy had been instituted, and some of these players, I guess, bought into that old philosophy. How easy was it to get this new philosophy implemented, and when did you see these kids start to buy into it?
Well, yeah, I don't know what the old philosophy was. It doesn't really matter. But if there was one, that's the whole thing. Some people aren't intentional about what they do. It's just like, hey, man, you have to have a plan and a focal point. And you have to sometimes, I mean, really, if you think about it, if you've had success in the past, and it doesn't mean you always have to repeat the same steps to get there, but it's a pretty good indicator. And, you know, having had teams, you know, like I say, or players 5 in the country or teams 16 in the country, you kind of know some of the things you have to do. And that's exactly what I said. You have to work on your fundamentals. I mean, there's just no shortcuts in tennis. You can't pop a pill. It's not a drive-through, you know, restaurant. You can't just get fast tennis, you know, like you can fast food. You got to put in the hard work, discipline, and the fundamentals. And then they just don't fall apart under pressure. So I just don't think the biggest thing for them was getting this focus, somebody who believed in them that, hey, if you do these things, it pays off. It has to. I mean, think about it. I mean, if you just work on the right stuff over and over, the right stuff over and over and over, and that's what I talk about, even like positioning your opponents to death. Man, you could hit the greatest ground stroke in the world, but if you're 10 feet behind the baseline, it's not happening. You got to get inside the baseline. You got to look for position. You got to take time away from your opponent. But you need somebody, you know, hounding you or, you know, working on it all the time to become inbred, because for most players, it's just not. It's just they're still way back there doing things. And I give them a story. I had a guy who was, when I was at Irvine, he was a great player. You know, he was top 10 out of South Africa. And we were playing in school, and he knew on paper he should have beat this guy, and he was losing. And we're playing Fresno State. And so he lost the first set, and he goes, Coach, he goes, what's going on? I said, look, man, I said, you are an all-court player. You're a phenomenal athlete. You work harder than anybody. You're in tremendous shape. You're an all-court athlete. You are 10 feet behind the baseline. This guy's driven you back. You can't attack. You couldn't attack your grandmother from there, you know? So I said, and notice he's two hands off both sides. And his right side, he doesn't react behind himself as well as he does his backhand side. So, but you can't attack that if you're that far back. I need you to stand close to the baseline and redirect the ball and get it behind him. And so he ends up winning 3 sets. And it was because he got back to what his game was, which is attacking, you know, putting pressure on the guy. So it's getting guys to understand who they are and what their game is, and then saying, look, we've got a plan. Here it is. Let's go for it. And people rise to the occasion. The expectations are high. You have to set the expectations and say, hey, this is what it's going to be, and this is what it takes. And, you know, people will follow. And so what happened was, even very shortly after that, about a month, we had our first tournament. I had coaches coming up to me and saying, man, these guys are completely different. You know, and I said, well, what do you mean? Because to me, I see them every day, and I'm thinking, okay, I see the things we need to work on, and you just keep pressing and keep working on it. And, you know, it's like if your kid, you know, somebody hasn't seen your kid for 2 months, all of a sudden they come up and go, wow, he's grown up like a weed. Well, you're around him all the time, so you don't necessarily notice. So they said, man, these guys are disciplined, they're focused, and they just have a different era about them, aura. So, you know, fast forward a long time, and I've heard that throughout the year, you know, multiple boosters or friends of the program, they would say these things. And so the fast forward to the end of the year, we're playing what team eventually became the conference champions. And this team hadn't beaten them in 9 years. But to me, because my standard is not beating those guys, it's beating better teams. I mean, they're a good team. All credit to them. But that's not what my goal is. My goal is to get a team somewhere up here. And other things are just a process in getting there. And so this was just a process. And so, you know, the coach came up to me before the match and said, hey, man, you know, these guys, they're different. And again, it was a different coach. And I asked him, I said, well, what do you mean? Can you be specific? So, I had some feedback. And he said, well, no. He said, look at that. I mean, just even the warm-up, man, these guys look like they mean business. I mean, they're disciplined. They're focused. They fight. These guys fight, you know. And so I'm thinking, what else would you do? So I guess, you know, again, my perspective is, you know, kind of like, well, what do you expect? And so during the match, while I was coming down to the end, we had three setters that determined the final outcome. And one of my guys, my number one guy, started cramping at the end. And but we ended up winning it. And so after the match, he came up to me and says, told you so. And I said, man, I really appreciate that you guys are class act and, you know, good luck in conference, and they ended up winning it. So anyways, it didn't take long to answer your question, but it was throughout the year where you see gains. And, you know, sometimes you still have to, when really the pressure starts hitting and the dual matches, you see where some of the old beliefs, some made prior or personal or individual belief systems come in and, you know, that sort of thing. So, you address those along the way and you just have to say, hey, you know, so I have a lot of team talks and I sit down, we chat about things, we read things and, you know, get them to understand, you know, competition better. Big thing is controlling momentum. I think Chuck Ricci, you know, one of your hosts, he did a great job years ago on a book he wrote, and I've used it for years, just the idea of momentum management. If you can control momentum, you can control sports. So.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And Chuck does a wonderful job of explaining all that information in those books and then on air as well. You inherited a mixed bag of players. You got some internationals. You've got some Americans on your team. Do you like that idea? Do you like the mix of those players, Steve?
Yes. And I know it's a touchy subject for some. And, you know, you talk about go back to the NCAAs, and, it's, you know, there's boatload of, you know, it's a mix. And, you know, for a time, you know, like when I was at Irvine, my top players were Americans, but then I had some foreign guys. And, you know, what I found over the years is tennis is an international sport, and the flavor of it is the thing I really enjoy is a lot of the international guys are really mature. They come over, you know, they're used to traveling and doing things, and they just have a different outlook on life, and they don't assume just because they have a certain ranking they deserve this and that. A lot of them, but then you have good old American work ethic where some of these you can't find it anywhere else in the world where American guys just work hard and they understand it's just the fight and the camaraderie, and that's just a neat thing. So I think the combination of the two is really good. You know, I'm always looking for, as I say in my recruit video on the website. I want, first and foremost, and this, because this kind of mirrors what I was like as a player, I want athletes. I want competitive athletes. And they need good sports. And I have a whole distinction between being a good sport, loving to win and hating to lose, and would you rather play ugly and win or play well and lose? I mean, I think that reveals a lot about a player. But, you know, deep down inside, I'm extremely competitive. People might say that, but if you get on the ultimate field with me or you get any particular competitive situation, you'll find out how competitive I am. But I won't sacrifice that at all for the integrity of a sport or sportsmanship. And so this is the second thing, is I want guys who are, you know, not only fierce competitors and athletes, because I can train an athlete, you know. When you're at mid-majors, you have to, unless you just got boatloads of money, you actually have to coach. You have to teach these guys. You're fundamentally, first and foremost, a teacher, and you have to have those tools. And I think guys will respect that. If you don't have the tools, a lot of times your players won't respect. And so in terms of the international and foreign, you know, I want guys who are athletes, and I want guys who, you know, are coachable, and definitely have some of the physical attributes that you can train to be an all-court player. When you can put pressure on people, that's really important.
Well, Steve,
Yeah, no, I'm here. I just wanted to ask, you know, with all this implementation of positive philosophy and having your team move into a direction, did these kids embrace that, or was there some resistance?
No, there wasn't any resistance. I mean, I had guys. In fact, one of the fun photos I have is after the first day of practice, I took the first practice, they were standing. The second photo was they're all on the ground, exhausted, but it was, you know, it was more staged. They kind of lied there. And they had smiles on their faces. And this is after running a boatload, having, you know, probably playing, you know, two a days before the season, so we were allowed to play for quite a long time. And I think they just loved the idea. Now, the question is, when it gets later in the season and guys are tired, you got to be able to, have ebbs and flows in the season to say, okay, you guys are tired, you need a break, let's go light, let's go fun, let's have a little mixture, let's, you know, do things like that. But, oh, there's definite, I in no way, and not in a blind sense at all. I mean, you know what you're doing, and you're willing to take advice from, you know, people and talk to your captains. And so there's several times throughout the year I say, hey, guys, tell me what's going on. Is anybody kind of fallen by the wayside? What do we need to correct? What do we need to address? That sort of thing. And so, you know, my captains were, very, very focused on staying on task, and they felt, you know, so there's a lot of agreement. So a lot of cohesion in that sense. So that was good.
It seems to be what you brought to the program there is an attitude of, as you mentioned, the focus, just moving these kids into a positive direction. You know, it was a little rough year for you. Was it something that you anticipated, or was it something that happened as you went along that you didn't win as many matches as you thought?
Yeah, even schedule-wise, I mean, it doesn't bother me. I mean, like I say, I'm competitive and I want to win, but it's like, look, it's a process. And so it's kind of like Wayne Bryan, I said, he made a great point. He uses this example regarding the Twins. You know, my guys used to play, you know, his Mike and Bob at Stanford. And you know, if you have a lot of times, you have a lot of breakdowns before you have breakthroughs, or you have, losses. I mean, when they say, you know, you learn a lot from your losses and mistakes, I'll be the first one to say, I'm not sure about that. I learn a lot better after I've won. It's a lot easier for me after I've beaten somebody and played poorly. I can go, you know what, I'm going to go work on that shot. And in the next round, be better. Because if you lose, you got another 2 weeks to get ready for the next tournament or whatever. So it's much more fun and much more, I think, you can learn from winning, I think, extremely well. You know, after a win, you humbly sit down and say, okay, what do I need to work on? Because that's just, I go, whew, I got lucky on that one. So, and that's a lot easier to stomach than a loss. So for these guys, I think part of it is, because it had been prior, the team had lost. And so to me, it was, that can't be the focus. The focus is, you know, if you're always thinking about that, I mean, that just tightens people up. What you got to focus on is, look, are you doing the right thing? If you're doing the right thing, eventually it'll work, you know. And, you also obviously have to have the horses. You have to have guys that can come in, you know, and get the job done. But, and here's a flip side is, you know, I was talking to Phil Coach, and he says, well, yeah, I got to water down the schedule to make sure this, you know, we get some wins. And, yeah, I understand that. But then it's a false sense of security. There's this balance. And to me, it's like the schedule, actually, one of the first things I did when I came in is I toughened up the schedule because I said, guys, this is where we got to be. I'm not interested in can you beat XYZ. I want to see what you do against these guys. You know, and so next year the schedule is going to be even tougher. And so, look, I've never had a losing schedule season as a player or as a coach. I've always been above 500. So, yeah, that was rough. But to me, that's like, that's not, I can't focus on that, you know. And if people, it's funny, even when I was at UC Irvine, I used to have people occasionally come up to me and say, so how's the team, how are you guys doing this year? I said, oh, man, we're doing pretty well. I said, well, what's your record? I'm thinking, what difference does that make? You know, I felt like asking them, that's like a dumb question. What does that mean? Because it's like if I just played USC, UCLA, Pepperdine, and maybe one other top 10 team or whatever it was at the time, my first four matches, well, what do you expect if we're like 25 or 30 in the country, right? But then we win the next four, or then we build ourselves up. And the whole point of playing tough matches is so you get better and you kind of get it, look in the mirror a little bit. So, anyways, that's aside from that affecting my overall record as a coach. I mean, that's not what's going to make or break me or define me. So
you mentioned earlier in the
developing the players.
Go ahead. You mentioned earlier in the broadcast that you were going to improve the schedule. Are you one of those coaches that believes, like Chuck does, a third of the opponents can't win against, a third we don't know if we're going to win against, and a third we know we're definitely going to win against?
Well, if you have the luxury to choose. So the way our conference is, and so there's some matches your travel, all that stuff determines that a little bit. When I was in Southern Cal, you could play, 20 people in a day. I mean, there's so many teams around. But most teams don't have that luxury. So, one of my deals was always, I used to sit actually and go through the rankings and say, okay, I'm going to play 25% in the top 25. I'm going to pay 25% in the top 50, and then on down. And that's how I, made the schedules. So, yeah, you have to – I think that it's a lot easier to go third like he was doing. It's interesting with this universal tennis rating, you can actually look at a team's strength that you've never seen before and say, look, how do they compare to us? How do they compare to other teams we play? And it's a very accurate rating. And so you can actually do some of your scheduling based on that. So I probably the following year I'll be doing that a little bit to make sure that you can – just get more teams so you can kind of have a better idea of the competitive nature of a match. But you could play a team and say, oh, I've never heard of that team. But I mean, because, Chuck and I have both been on the national scene, playing a lot of national-level teams, and you play a team that you've never heard of before, and, they got a bunch of foreign guys, and they're pretty good. So you never heard of them before, but the universal tennis rating will help you kind of get an idea of the competition level, which is really helpful.
Are you a big proponent of the UTR?
Well, I'm getting kind of more educated on it. I'm playing around with it, and I think the idea is a good one. I'll give you a perfect example. You can have a team that is. I'm looking at this, and let's say where I used to coach UC Irvine. They had players that were free. They had a seven, I think their top aggregate six players were 77. We were 60-something, or 70 or something. So, and they won the match. And if you look through these matches and you line them up, you can see that it's very accurate. Obviously, with any kind of rating like that, the more that's pumped into the system, the more accurate it is. Here's one of the things is I think, juniors, for example, they want to go away from local tournaments because, hey, I don't want to play that because it's not strong enough, et cetera, or I want to avoid a bad loss. And it just promotes skipping and moving around, and it promotes people with more money can travel and all that, as opposed to if you just have a competitive match at home, it still helps you. And then you don't play the less competitive matches. So if somebody's the juniors, if somebody's an eight and somebody's a nine, well, you don't play eight the first round. You just they're in the draw fighting each other the first couple rounds, and the eights play nines, and the nines play tens, that sort of thing. And then that way you're able to have more competitive matches each day as opposed to going in and blowing somebody out 0-0. And it wasn't quite worth the two-hour drive. So I think even in the pros, that happens. But, sometimes you're talking in the youth, a kid shows up and then he gets a bye one round and he wins 0-0. It wasn't even a match and et cetera. So, I mean, maybe that's just the history and the nature of the game, but I think this could help, mitigate that sort of thing.
Right. Now, Steve, are you in the transition here of 2014 to 2015? Are you going to make some big changes in the program, continue on with what you've been doing, or have you got things set in place there?
Well, no, it's a process. I mean, we have to get some different guys in, still working on that. And then the schedule change, we're playing SMU going out there. And we got some, we're playing more Pac-12 teams, even though we're not Pac-12. And, and some other, mid-major schools that are solid. So, just trying to get the schedule jacked up. And then I think the next thing for next year is we got to start working on a base. I have a pretty good, email base out there that I try and keep people abreast of things, and I get replies a lot from people, hey man, thanks for staying in touch and sending these video clips and all this. So in terms of the media and outreach, I think we need to start really focusing in on maybe getting an indoor, a primary indoor facility, updated, that sort of thing. I think that'd be a big plus, get that at least on the docket. But you just got to keep pressing upward and onward. The goal next year would be obviously to get the, to do more damage in conference and have a shot.
Definitely. And now, Steve, we've had a year where we've had a lot of a scoring change proposed. Did your conference encounter the scoring change through the course of the year?
Yeah, that was interesting. In fact, we had a conference call, and I was real appreciative of their allowing me to have the floor on multiple issues. And having different awards for the conference. And I think there's, several things of the conference that would change, and they were very, getting more teams in the conference, and they were very receptive to that. And I think almost unanimously the coaches, agreed with some of the things I had to propose. So this was one of the things. I think it was kind of oddly done and quickly done, at the beginning of the year. And in fact, all the coaches that I talked to there were, man, we did not like the current format. In fact, if you were at the NCAAs just recently, it was highly engaging, and even though it was long, I was watching the UCLA women's match, and it was an incredible almost comeback. I mean, literally points from a dramatic comeback, and Stella and Rance, I they're great, great people and friends, and the coaches at UCLA, and they fell short, but so the format though was great. Now, I totally get it. You have indoor courts. You need to shorten the format a little bit, the time. So I don't mind that at all. I would agree with Wayne Bryant that, hey, if you want to have a TV format, well, then when it comes to TV, then change the format, just like other sports do. But your regular days are different. But the same token, we had better fans than the program's ever had. The format was pretty short. It allowed us to play multiple matches, and that's one of the things in the schedule I have to do is I have to try and get as many double matches as possible. You play one match, in the morning, one in the afternoon, et cetera. So that allows you to do that. But I'm a big proponent of doubles, in tournaments, getting juniors to play them, and among other things, in sportsmanship in tournaments. I think there's a way to intentionally foster that, kind of like the Little Mo does. But anyway, that's another old story. But so I'm not very keen on butchering doubles, more and more than it has been. I think if there's a way to keep that a little more even-handed, like for men, I mean, it's just, we have big, there's big serves and only six games. I mean, that's just like rolling dice. And, so even if you may tweak that a little bit and then shorten the men's singles a little bit, I mean, then you can get, I mean, people love doubles. I mean, you come to a match, it's exciting, the doubles point. That's exciting. And doubles, singles is too, but there's, you get 12 guys and gals on a court because it's three matches and four people on there. It's there's a lot of action. And I think to shorten that is a bit of a disservice. So, I'm not 100%. I'm not sure where it's going to fall out. It'll be interesting. And how the process is in the voting. That was my big thing that I would express is, look, if we're going to vote on this, we need to vote. It shouldn't be handed down. And then secondly, with good discussion, good, open, really good discussion, not just a few emails back and forth where, half the time you send something, an email, people don't read between the lines or it's hard to express it clearly. So anyways, there was a couple changes and it was a bit odd.
Yeah. And Steve, we've been in a situation here with American tennis just in general where we've kind of gone into a glut. And years ago, we used to be able to rely on colleges and universities giving us some pros into the ATP and WTA tours. It seems like that over the last, and Stevie Johnson is climbing up the ranks. I don't mean to take anything away from him. And then we've got John Isner. Mm-hmm. But with all the other sports turning out, all these professional athletes, year in and year out, you take the NBA draft, the NFL draft, and these college kids are making it. Why aren't more and more college kids making the turn into the Pro Tour?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know the, for example, there may be some other whys. you know, like obviously my players played against John Isner, and, you know, so I mean, obviously he just, John Roddick, who's the coach of OU. I mean, you know, there's a lot of these guys, you know, who, well, John didn't, but Isner did, but Roddick didn't. But yeah, go on into the pros, and there's a lot of them that played college. And if you know, in fact, I have a list of players that, you know, my guys have played or I've played that were, you know, on the Pro Tour who played college, and there's a boatload of them. Well, I think it is not going so far that way. I'd have to look at the numbers percentage-wise and if there's been a change. If somebody had that, I'd be interested. But, you know, the whys, I'm not sure. I don't know if it, you know, I'm not a politics guy. I don't know to what degree it's the USGA program. I have no idea. I have a former player of mine who's a great guy, and he works at the Carson Center down there, and they've got some great players, you know, and Chris is a great guy, great coach, and you know, I think it goes both ways, you know, I think there's two avenues. You can develop them in college, you can develop them there. It just depends on what the situation is, I guess. But, you know, it's like my son, he's 12, and he wants to play professionally, and, you know, he wants to go to Stanford, and I said, well, dude, you're going to have to get your grades up big time, and you're going to have to we're going to have to get you playing a heck of a lot more. But I told him, I said, look, you, because, you know, he had, at a time, he even my own son, and I have a PhD, and you know, I'm very academic oriented. And he said, well, do I have to go to school to play, you know, professionally? I said, well, no. I said, but you're going to. I said, it's a phenomenal training ground. I mean, it's one of the best there is. I mean, and if you treat it so, and if you work hard and work on those things, it's, you know, Stevie Johnson's a perfect example. And so I think college tennis is a phenomenal training ground for that. And but the opportunity, and when I talk about the focus, the fundamentals, opportunity, et cetera, the opportunity has to be for those guys. So I think one of the things that we need to do is we got to have more opportunity for the guys to play, you know, futures. And the problem is there's so few of them. It's like they're here in the West Coast, they're over here, you know, it'd be nice to have more of them. So how do we redistribute that? I don't know. I don't know if that's a political question of like, look, man, you know, I think in Europe things are more more egalitarian. Things are more grassroots and spread out. Here it's kind of you get a group of few people and you focus on them as opposed to, hey, let's get it out there because athletes are abundant. And you it's just like what Wayne Bryan would say, you know, Southern Cal's done pretty good in producing great world-class players. Well, those are just regular coaches producing those players. You know, they're just right. your club pros and all that. So it can be done from that level, clearly. So the more futures tournaments we have around, the more that the wealth is distributed, you might say, in terms of, you know, if we're going to spend money on players, it's like do it on a grander scale where maybe not a few get so much, but more get an opportunity to take your athletic ability. You know, I don't know how that's done or, you know, like I say, I'm not in the politics side of it, but I definitely know that, you know, if you get athletes and train them, boy, a lot of people can really come up through and do really well. So,
all right. Now, Steve, you and I have been talking behind the scenes here, and we're excited to work. Can you kind of give us an idea of what you might be covering on a future show?
Oh, okay. Yeah, you cut out a little bit there, but I think you were just talking about a future hour that I would be doing.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think to me it's really exciting because I like to talk about, you know, in some ways all things tennis, and in terms of from a coaching perspective, from a player's perspective, from a parent's perspective, from a coach parent, you know, dealing with you know, parents who are coaches of their kids. You know, the mental side, technical, tactical, you know, all these different aspects of it. You know, I want to be able to promote those things and open it up for discussion and have guests.
Well, Steve, I don't think you're going to have a problem with that. You know, you and I have been on the phone now and the interview now for about an hour, and we haven't run out of things to talk about yet.
Yeah, let me. I don't know how much time. We might have only 30 seconds, but here's a perfect example. Sportsmanship, if we really care about sportsmanship, if the USDA really cared about it, I think Little Mo does this right. Because I've seen examples of the opposite. If a tournament's sanctioned, you have to have sportsmanship awards and umpires who are there who actually call kids on poor sportsmanship and reward kids for good acts of good sportsmanship and hand out tokens, and kids at the end of a tournament can, you know, get string or get things because of their good attitudes. And then you award, you know, trophies, you know, for the most exceptional sportsman. I think when you really want to develop something, you have to be intentional about it. You know, it's just not the lip service. And I think that would be something we could do.
Oh, I agree with that. I like the idea of bringing the technical and the tactical side into our network. It's an area that we don't discuss enough.
Yeah, well, I think one of the biggest things is our mental, because most of the tennis is played between points, you know, time-wise. If you, you know, we have, you know, that time, you know, your average athlete, elite athlete, tennis player spends 15 seconds minimum between. Well, all that stuff, that's where planned positive physical response, relaxation, preparation, or ritual come in. Most people don't deal with that. They go straight from point to point. Even good college players, you know, they do that. To be a great player, you have to have really good control of the mental side, what you're telling yourself, being a good doubles partner between points, and then making sure that you're executing plans. I think a lot of people just don't do that. So I think those would be one of the things we talk about.
Yeah, and do you think you can line up any guests, Steve?
I think I can. I don't want to say who right now, because I mean, I have a whole list of guys out there, but and gals, but I'm sure we could some past pro greats, current pros, coaches, coaching duos. I think there's some tremendous coaching duos that have been together for many, many years at elite programs. The head and assistant have been kind of like a tandem joined at the hip, and I think that's some great wisdom and fun to listen to. So I think there's a lot of those things.
I couldn't agree more, Steve, and I look forward to you joining our network. And I've had a great time interviewing you today. You and I have spent some time on the phone before, but just to get down and sit down with an hour with you, quite the honor, and to get to pick your brain a little bit as well. It's been fun today.
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, it was good. Getting used to that, and I apologize sometimes for asking if you were there. I couldn't tell if the delay. I know one time we got cut off just chatting, and I felt like I was in the bathroom talking to myself. So I wanted to make sure I wasn't my technology didn't fail on this side. So.
No, not at all. I think we had a good interview, and I look forward to talking to you off the air as well, Steve. Thanks for coming on today.
Okay, thanks.
Yep. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Head coach Steve Clark. Steve is, as we mentioned, the head coach out there at Eastern Washington University, and he's been doing a fabulous job. We're also excited that Steve, and we're in the talks with Steve to help us here on the UR Tennis Network. Looks like that he'll be producing his own, or will be producing a show with Steve in the future. We've got to work out some details and get things going, but I know that after listening to him today that he's not going to have any problem whatsoever in contributing to our network, so I want to thank him for getting that done. I also want to remind you that next week we've got another show coming on. Looks like we'll have Coach Chuck Creasy come in and talk about the Men's Division I Tennis Association. This is an association that Chuck and a group of coaches have created as an alternative to the ITA, and looking forward to having him come on and visit with us about that. So I want to thank you again for listening in. I encourage you to get out there and hit some tennis balls in the future, and have a great week. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Warning. Orthopedic surgeons are seeing an increase in overuse injuries when young athletes perform the same repetitive stressful motions over and over. Pitching, tennis, weight training, even long swimming workouts can cause overuse trauma that may require surgery. If your kids play and train hard, visit orthoinfo.org or stopsportsinjuries.org. A message from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons and the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine.